I have two of your papers now. One arrived this morning, February the 11th, and one arrived several days ago, which is this is answer to your paper of February 7th, and it's page 24, 1944-45. You start with a quotation from Roosevelt and Hopkins' book. In regard to the Japanese codes before Pearl Harbor. In some way, the fact that we had this code, rather than codes, had leaked out to a few who had informed the Dewey regime, meaning Bell, I believe, whoever was his head man at that time in the management and publicity connected to the campaign. Of course, it was of tremendous importance to us to keep this code business quiet, because if we lost it, we lost the most valuable information that we could possibly have gotten regarding the Japanese operations. It was the same code that they had at the time of Pearl Harbor. At this particular time that I'm referring to, when we learned that the code was in the knowledge of the code was in the possession of somebody connected with the Dewey affair, we were chopping down the Japanese sea power, particularly their transport cargo boats, with great rapidity, and in the process of rapidly bringing the China Sea into an area free of the Japanese shipping, and forcing them into a consideration of even moving their head government over to across the streets. Parentheses, I'm having difficulty finding the right words right now, end of parentheses. Just how this code business leaked out, I don't know, but always somebody talks. And it had been very difficult to keep it absolutely quiet, because each fella who was at all in the upper reaches felt that he had a right to know. I wouldn't have this put into your record papers, but I found in one case that Paul Watson was taking the translations of the code that had been sent to the president and putting them in his wastebasket. And we were having a terrible time keeping this quiet. The various offices in the War Department, notably the Secretary of Wars and the Assistant Secretary, Jack McCloy's office, had the advantage of reading these translations of the code, or rather particularly looking at my record book of the day's messages of every kind, and when I found there was some loose talking by some of their office force, we stopped that wide distribution, stopped particularly the distribution of my operation book, and just sent up particular papers for the secretary or McCloy's information. Incidentally, McCloy was the channel of information for the Secretary of War. Now, we learned, I've forgotten how, that Mr. Dewey not only had this information, but there was a plan to use it on his campaign. And he was en route at that time from point to point, and I think in Oklahoma at the time we picked this up. I prepared a letter, which is in the records, in which I spoke for Admiral King and myself, and asked Mr. Dewey to read the first paragraph, and if he would not go along with what we're going to propose, not to read any further in the letter. And he wouldn't agree to that. I sent an officer to him, and the officer, I think, has just been made a brigadier general not so long ago. The officer came back and said that Mr. Dewey didn't feel that he could make a commitment like that when he was in the middle of a campaign and a representative of the Republican Party. So I modified it to the extent of agreeing to his showing it to one person, who I think was the treasurer of New York, but he was on the political staff of Mr. Dewey. But that can be checked up very quickly. And the agreement being that it would not be divulged to anybody else at all. Well, as a matter of fact, in the end, this individual, whose name I don't get, talked to the Life magazine people after the war and disclosed the fact we had the code, and it destroyed the English code system. I know they had 10,000 people involved in one office there that had the machinery and all for rapidly deciphering these messages, and that was largely destroyed, and our code business was put out of business completely by this disclosure. So it was a very serious matter, but it was particularly serious at the time I first mentioned, because we were rapidly destroying, or the Navy was in particular, and some of our aircraft and the Army were, all the Japanese shipping in the China Sea and further north. And it was only a short time until we almost wiped it all out. Well, of course, that was a tremendous asset, and it was also a tremendous help to us, because in the guidance of our other operations, particularly the naval operations and the air operations, which touched on the China Sea area. Well, I've explained what the agreement was with Mr. Dewey and what the denouement was, which played quite a part when they began the Pearl Harbor investigation against me after the war was over. And they dragged out into the open the fact of the code, because Senator Ferguson, I believe, anyway, is from Michigan, insisted the public must know about this. Well, of course, it just raised the devil with what we had at that time in the way of secrecy in this code business. And there was so much political performance going on at that time, and particularly against Mr. Roosevelt, which dragged me in, of course, into a leading position in it, that it was highly destructive in its results. In this business, I wrote the letter to Admiral Dewey on my own initiative, and I showed it to King, and I said if he didn't care to be mentioned in this, concluding with me, we would just drop that out and I would take the full responsibility for the letter. Well, he assented to be included in it, and we were trying to stop any possibility of this code being disclosed right in the middle of this campaign by the heir of the Army and the Navy, and the Navy itself under Admiral Halsey, in the China Sea area, which led, as the records will show, one of the most rapid destruction of the shipping of a nation that I think has ever occurred in warfare. So we had a very hard time with this, and we had a hard time in the War Department keeping it quiet. We had a hard time because if they knew its existence, they all wanted to have it. And of course, you know that a secret only holds two people. After that, it becomes public property. It was furnished to the State Department for a long time. I don't remember how long that went on, but I know way early in the game, in the first years before we actually got into the war, a new appointment of an undersecretary in the State Department enthusiastically called me up on the telephone to tell me what interesting reading it was. Well, I suppressed the telephone call right there and tried to suppress the whole matter under discussion. But we were unaccustomed to such business, and there was great freedom of talk, and I think in that way, somehow or other, the whole matter leaked out and became into the possession of Mr. Dewey's henchmen and was going to be used as a threat against Roosevelt, I believe, to prove that he was allowed the war to develop with his knowledge or with his assistance. In regard to the question that if General Arnold had been at Yawley, he would have been able to make the president listen to the Air Force intelligence, which showed there was no need of the Russian help. The question is, what was this change due to a desire to satisfy the Prime Minister, or to permit the Canadians to take their forces out of Italy, or some other consideration? It was in part due to the necessity of transferring Canadian troops north in preparation for the landing in Flanders. And it was in part due to the needs of that army in Italy, meaning both the combination of the various countries involved there, for more air during this period. Question 57. In regard to this, I felt that in certain places the Navy procedure was wasteful of shipping, but it generally came from local reasons. I remember I sent General Arnold out to the Pacific in the early days to the headquarters of the naval commander in that area, and I've forgotten the name of the large land space or island off Australia where we had our, where the headquarters were established. And I should have a map here, but I haven't. And I told him in particular while he was out there looking into the air setup and all, which was being established firmly and increased in order to assist in the defense of Guadalcanal, which was under heavy attack at that time, that he would personally count the shipping in the anchorage there. And as I recall, he got 92 vessels there that accumulated there. The admiral was hesitant about sending them to Guadalcanal because they'd get under bombing if they went into the tedious beach landings which were necessary. And the result was he was holding this shipping up, all cargo laden, in the harbor there. And of course we brought pressure to bear to have it cut down. The wastefulness occurred though through the difficulty of landing on Guadalcanal and the vessels going up and then coming back without discharging their load and then being held for another attempt at the same place, which is quite different from just the plain charge of being wasteful of shipping. Everybody had to be watched on this count, because the tendency was if you had a ship to hold on to it. And what we were after was a general distribution that could be let out as necessity demanded. There was always this shortage, cleared almost the end of the war, and it was always very difficult to handle, particularly as the Navy would naturally, their local commander, and Washington would resent Army inspections going into the place and checking them up on, and the accusation being made that they were wasteful of shipping, they would probably turn around and say that we were wasteful of shipping. So it was a two-sided affair, and very, very difficult to handle. But the, on the back of that, of course, was the British pressure, which was a very real pressure and a justified pressure, but not always particularly tactful. '58, in regard to Admiral Wilson, General Wilson. Wilson came over here very fully informed as to the relationship between Field Marshal Sir John Dill and myself. And I think he tried his best to develop the same relationship with me. I didn't help him too much. And for the reason that the relationship between Dill and myself covered a long period of time and a very intimate understanding of each other. And it took me time to feel out the real Wilson. And I was also a little sensitive about it because I thought that Wilson had possibly not held to his command situation in the Mediterranean in quite the way that Dill would have done it. In other words, that he yielded to pressures coming largely from the Prime Minister, which was also natural, but to be guarded against. Incidentally, they were two quite different characters. Dill was the most unusual man. He not only had a very remarkable character, but he had even more remarkable courage in carrying out his duties. He had been Chief of Staff of the British Army and had after that come to this country. And his opinions of affairs for quite a while didn't jibe with those of Mr. Churchill and some of the others. And that made it a rather delicate business. But he talked with extreme frankness. Now, we had to be very careful about this. And I don't know whether this should be in any way referred to outright in your record, but it finally reached the point where Mr. Roosevelt was always very sensitive about the reports on his own conduct of affairs. He didn't want a record of cabinet meetings. He didn't give us the messages he was sending half the time. He would communicate with Churchill. He'd receive a message from Churchill, and I would be wholly unaware of it, though it directly affected the affairs of the Army and the air and maybe the Navy. In this peculiar way, I kept track of this matter. When a message would go from the President to Churchill, addressed to my naval friend, who was Churchill, that would immediately go into the special distribution that was regulated by the affairs of the British officialdom, so that everybody that should know that immediately got a copy of it. And of course that would right away go to the chiefs of staff and the senior of them. Then it was Dill should know it in Washington, so Dill would get a copy of it. Then Dill would come over to my office and I would get Mr. Roosevelt's message through Field Marshal Sir John Dill. Otherwise I wouldn't know what it was. I had to be very careful that nobody knew this. Nobody in the War Department, and certainly not the Chiefs of Staff, because Dill would be destroyed in a minute if this was discovered. But he knew I had to have it or should have it, and he just brought it to me and read it to me, sat down opposite me at my desk and went over this. Well, of course, Wilson didn't have the benefit of all of those exchanges that we had. This was quite a risky thing for Dill, but he realized that we just had to have the information. Why should the British Chiefs of Staff have it It is from our president and the American chiefs of staff not have it. But it was just Mr. Roosevelt's desire for secrecy. And but it went to everybody else, and so I would get it through Dill, which is a rather unusual circumstance. And I got the other the same way when the prime minister sent a message to Mr. Roosevelt. Dill would bring me a copy. And I never disclosed that fact to any of the chiefs of staff, and certainly not to the president, but it kept me au courant with what was going on. I couldn't have gotten any other way. And I could understand exactly why they were doing as they did, but I didn't think they quite understood the absolute necessity of the information on my side of the operations. Dill was thoroughly familiar with this. He'd been chief of staff of the British Army. He was representative of the British Chiefs of Staff in Washington, and he was interested solely in the most advantageous conduct of the war. But neither one of us could discuss it with anybody. I'll go even further to say, though you have to guard this pretty carefully, that Dill would frequently get messages from Mr. Churchill and ask him to ascertain General Marshall's possible view of this. Dill would come over and read me Mr. Churchill's communication, and then he and I would make up a reply. And very often when I wouldn't agree to it at all, very decidedly wouldn't agree to it, I would comment very forcibly and very freely to Dill in a way I couldn't possibly comment to the Prime Minister. Then Dill would report that to Mr. Churchill, that's what I said to Dill. And that way my own feeling got across to Mr. Churchill. And it is a rather curious setup, but a very effective one in this business, because these were all strong men, Mr. Roosevelt, Mr. Churchill, and the coordination of these matters was of vital importance. And I was in a position, so far as it affected military affairs and things of that sort, to know better almost than any of them how important it was that we should have certain of this information. And I got it in that way. But I've never disclosed it until this minute. I have no particular comment on this. I still agree with the decision of the American Chiefs of Staff on the matter. It was something for General Eisenhower's commander. 60. In regard to the political aspects, which some British historians and some British officials feel that I was not sufficiently mindful of, and General Eisenhower and General Bradley, I have this to say. We probably devoted more time in our discussions, our intimate discussions of the American Chiefs of Staff, to such matters as any other one subject, because we were very fearful that we might find our whole campaign upset by some political gesture. I frankly was fearful of Mr. Roosevelt introducing political methods, of which he was a genius, into a military thing which had to be on a fixed basis. And this was particularly so in regard to the Baltic states and the satellite states, and certain Mediterranean things. You can't treat military factors in the way you do political factors. It's quite a different affair. You have to be very exact, very clearly informed and very precise in what you say in regard to military things. Now, as to whether we did not regard the diplomatic factors sufficiently, I repeat again that we discussed these more than anything else. But that was Mr. Roosevelt. And our problem was to be on our guard that the military picture, meaning air, navy, and army, was not completely disjointed by some, I would call it, irreverent political gestures which were made without due thought to what was going on at the time. Of course, Mr. Churchill and the President were the dominant factors in all arrangements, in all guidance, and they were the great political leaders of their country. That was the thing. But they were also the military leaders, and it was quite a delicate issue back and forth, particularly in matters like the Mediterranean, the soft belly of Europe, the Balkan states, the marches on Berlin, and things of that sort. Well, there were a great many factors connected with all these things, but we had to give special regard to the particular military factors and make certain that there was no misunderstandings for a failure in this respect. I repeat again that I doubt if there was any one thing, except the shortage in LSTs, that came to our minds more frequently than the political factors. But we were very careful, exceedingly careful, never to discuss them with the British. And from that, they took the count that we didn't observe those at all. We observed them constantly, great frequency, and particular solicitude, so that there's no foundation in that. We didn't discuss it with them because we were not in any way putting our neck out as to political factors, which were the business of the head of the state, the president, who happened also to be the commander-in-chief. I've just discussed this pretty plainly, and I think to the full. When the final considerations came, the president sat in, or more than sat in, he called a meeting, and we discussed the thing. You take, for example, the subdivisions of Western Europe when we were trying to settle the apportionments for control as the peace was developed. I think we discussed halfway across the South Atlantic the various factors, you might say, of a political nature, which were at the president's deep concern in these matters and which affected vitally the decisions that were made, which now may seem military decisions, but they were very decided political decisions. 61. I do not think the military authorities should make any political decisions unless they're instructed accordingly, because the effects are too wide-reaching, there are too many influences involved, and it's quite a question how much of this would be familiar to the military participants. And also it must be remembered that the military responsibility in operations is very, very large, and it has with it the terrible measure of casualties. I know I was very careful to send Mr. Roosevelt every few days a statement of our casualties, and it was done in a very effective way, graphically and rather in colors, so that it would be quite clear to him when he had only a moment or two to consider it, because I tried to keep before him all the time the casualty results, and because you get hardened to these things, and has to be very careful to keep them always in the forefront of your mind. 62. No, I do not think we should have gone into Berlin at that time. I'm not so certain about Prague. I think it would have been better to probably have done this. However, it must be remembered that all this time we were trying to do business with Russia. We'd been fighting with them. They were a part of the armed forces, a very decided part. They played a great part in the fighting and the wearing down of the German strength. And we had to take that all into careful regard. At that time, towards the close of the struggle, they were exceedingly sensitive, looking all the time for something that would indicate that the British and Americans were preparing to go off alone and settle the thing in a way to their British-American satisfaction and to the disadvantage of the Russians. So we were very careful about this, the Americans more so than the British, because Mr. Churchill was quite positive in the matter, and events in time have rather proved that he was possibly more nearly right than the American position. But we were trying very hard to find a basis of negotiation to go along with the Russian government. Eisenhower was in a particularly trying position because in command of the troops, he was brought into constant situations that had to be handled with great delicacy. And almost invariably, he had to handle them in a way that displeased one party or the other. And I thought he did extraordinarily well in this matter. Now, just what the effect would have been of the question of Prague is open to discussion. I might say in all this, it's very much a Monday quarterback business, because all sorts of things have happened since those days. Our relations with the Russians at that time were quite different. They were always delicate. They were always jealous. And it was very, very hard to preserve a coordinated association with them. But we did it to a very large extent at that time, which is unthinkable today in the knowledge of later events. But nobody but the Lord could foresee all of that that has happened since. 63. I think your answer to that question in New York was correct. In the abstract. That in things like this, very often the people who are criticizing the decision now would have been the most vile attackers of it if it, at the time it had been carried out the way they advocate. 63. 63A. In regard to the message mentioned of April 5th, 1945, though I have not the records here, I think I know which one is mentioned. I believe it's the one that Mr. Churchill makes quite a point of in his book. I wrote the message and repeated it to Mr. Roosevelt at Warm Springs. it is a fact that more and more Mr. Roosevelt utilized my services in connection with the matters of this sort. But I wouldn't say they're unknown to the British, other than to say that we were not required to repeat every conversation that Mr. Roosevelt and I had to the British government. That was a matter to be decided between Mr. Roosevelt and myself, as he dictated. He had grown seemingly a little more dependent on me as the years went on. I don't think it was entirely a matter of ill health. At first he didn't accept my views on such matters very easily. He was accustomed to dealing with so many political factors where you have to be so careful and have to possess such a wide background of knowledge of the people involved that it is quite understandable for a long time he was rather hesitant about taking me into his confidence. Also, I had to be prudent. He'd appointed me without any large war experience except being with General Pershing in the First World War and for a time chief of operations of an army of almost 1 million men when I was pretty young. But it was quite a long time before he built up a confidence in me to anything like the extent that he apparently had in the last year of the war. I was very careful not to force issue on any of these things. And Harry Hopkins, I think, rendered me a great service because he was inclined to accept my views right along and would try to have Mr. Roosevelt well aware of them. But I might cite the fact that from the start, from the day I first met Hopkins, he insisted that I should go to Warm Springs with Mr. Roosevelt a day later, and explained to him the situation of the Army and its needs. This was in about Christmas time, 1939, I think. He was very firm in the necessity for me to go to Warm Springs. I might say that he never got me there. I was never invited to Warm Springs during the entire time, though Hopkins several times wanted to get me there. He did the same thing in regard to Hyde Park. Two or three times he thought it was very important that I should go to Hyde Park and talk these matters over with Mr. Roosevelt rather than have him do it. Again, he was unable to do it. So I never went to Hyde Park, and I never went to Warm Springs. I was not on that basis of intimate relationship with the president that a number of others were. I rather, in thinking of this question I've just been answering, it comes to my mind a message from Stalin in 1942, I think about April, when I was having lunch alone with Mr. Churchill in that basement dining room of his at 10 Downing Street. A message came from Stalin, which was very, very rude, very rough. And it had come that morning or within an hour of the time we sat down, I think. And Mr. Churchill showed it to me, quite furious. And he said he didn't see how he, as the political head of his country, could accept such a thing. the political head of the British Empire, such a message as that from Stalin. I was very new at the business then, but it seemed to me quite clear that Stalin was in a desperate situation. We all knew that. He was in desperate need of these things, which we couldn't furnish him. He saw only his side of it, which is not unnatural. We have that all the time. And he was a rough character. Anyone reading his early career would certainly agree to that statement. And this was a message written by the head of a country who was a dictatorial head, who had had a very rough time rising to that position, who was now in a desperate situation, facing possible defeat or destruction, and in tremendous need of these things he wanted, and he was to be forgiven if he wrote very much in character. And I thought the Prime Minister had to consider that. If that came from some other man in some other position, it'd be quite a different matter. But I think it was Stalin, au naturel. I remember that conversation took place at lunch down at Downing Street. And afterwards we sat out in the garden, as I recall, and he was telling me of some historic things that occurred right there. As a matter of fact, in speaking of relationships with my relationships with Mr. Roosevelt, where they had political significance, I was always involved in the problem of finding an opportunity to state my case. It was frequently said in those days by politicians who would see Mr. Roosevelt that they never got a chance to state their case. He was quite charming and quite voluble, and the interview was over before they got a chance to say anything. Well, I was aware of that, and it is undoubtedly Mr. Roosevelt's system in one way. And when I would have something particularly disagreeable, something that was very difficult for him to do at that time, and he didn't want such a matter to be brought up, he would be very communicative and would talk continually, and I would never get a look in till the time had expired. So I was very careful not to prolong such a discussion, to ask any questions about it, but I just stuck to the thing I was after, and whenever there was a pause, I started on with that. So one day he entertained me with what proved to be a very vital discussion or statement. He went on to explain to me just how he expected to handle the question of the Baltic states with the Russians. And that was a great problem at that time. Just how he would handle the issue of the Baltic states. And afterwards, I was quite provoked with myself because I was so intent on getting my point across, which was the reason for my call, and to avoid this discursive procedure of Mr. Roosevelt's to keep me from doing it, that I practically paid no attention at all to his discussion of this very vital political question. I always condemn myself in this respect, though the reason for it was very plain. 64, I did help draft a good many messages, many more towards the last years of the war, but there I wouldn't know whether it was a question of he failing health, he was saddling me with more responsibility, or he was giving me the compliment of having a greater trust in my judgment, in my ability to handle these matters. I don't recall this. 66. I don't recall that I did. There were some discussions with all the chiefs of staff, I think. I mean, with the American chiefs of staff, with Mr. Roosevelt, where this question came up. But I don't recall anything significant that came out of the discussions. 67. I don't recall that I did. 68. I think there's quite a possibility that the Germans and Japanese might have conceded the war a little earlier if it hadn't been for these unconditional surrender formula. However, I think it had a great psychological effect on our people, on the British people, and on the Allied people generally, as well as on the Germans when it was made at Yalta, because we'd been going through a period of defeats, and now this came out as a declaration to the world that we're going in this thing to the finish. I recall that my satisfaction in reading the decoded cablegrams or radiograms from the embassies, Japanese embassies in Europe, and before the people concerned became involved in the war with us. That would be the ambassadors from some of the Scandinavian countries, the ambassador in Moscow, the ambassador in Spain and Portugal, the ambassador in Switzerland, others like that. Now, in these decipherings came out the story of the pressure that they were exerting on the Japanese Prime Minister to bring the war to an end. And they, as I recall, they cited the severity of the terms that are being inflicted on these people by inflicted on Germany by the prolongation of the war. This was cited by some of these ambassadors. All this is in the records, of course, and you can get it straight from there. And they wanted a quick conclusion to the war with us, because, and the great British, because they had nothing to gain and everything to lose by it. And it would virtually destroy Germany, which it virtually did destroy. And I remember they used this expression once. They said, it is very important to get this. You're going to find the Americans the most difficult of all to deal with. Well, I took some satisfaction of that, for the reason that a democracy has a very hard time in a war, particularly at the start of a war. They never can get ready in advance. The conditions are such they're very susceptible to surprise action. And the arbitrary government, like the Hitler government, has every advantage in those respects. They're just bound to win at the start unless they're very, very stupid. Of course, in the end, if the democracy is a firm democracy, it builds up a power which outlasts the other, and the dictatorship bogs down. But it hadn't bogged down yet, and its firmness of control was illustrated by the results of the effort to assassinate Hitler. This reference to the American democracy was standing firm, was going to defeat these people, was impressed on all of these Japanese ambassadors. In the development of the bomb, Mr. Stimson was one of the group which was headed by the Vice President that Mr. Roosevelt in effect put in charge of the general development. I don't remember what my status was then, except it fell to me to make the preparations and still do it with secrecy. So we had to construct these huge plants down in the south and out on the Pacific coast, which were going to be required, and still try to do it in secrecy. Well, that was my job. I picked out the general that I put in charge of it, and I even tried to have it done without the knowledge of General Summerall, which I couldn't quite make, but he kept quiet about it. I never did know just how much General Blank told him. But anyway, I had to get the money, and I directed this, all these preliminary operations and the construction of the fair. Not that I knew anything about the technique at all, but to get the thing done, to mass the money and the men and everything of that sort. I was rather amused at myself, because as time wore on, these long statements that had come, that were filled with all the complicated procedures necessary in this matter, and the technical terms involved, I spent so much time with the Encyclopedia Britannica, or the dictionary, trying to interpret what they said, that I finally just gave it up, decided I never would quite understand it all. What I must understand was all the procedure concerned with getting this thing done. I obtained the first money by taking 20% of the appropriations concerning such matters in the development of bombs and artillery and kindred matters, which was legal. You could divert 20% away from appropriation to a somewhat similar matter, one connected with the defense, for example, and this bomb was certainly connected with the defense. We finally got to the point that I felt that we must get some authority from Congress. Of course, that is a very difficult, delicate thing. I don't know how much Mr. Simpson tells about in his book, but what actually happened was he and I had a meeting with the principal leaders on the Hill, the speakers and the chairman of the committees, and a very select group of men. And what we wanted from them was the assurance that if we put in for, I think it was $600 million, on what was then called the Manhattan Project, which was the name least liable to arouse some feeling of a mystery. You might have called it Hoboken, but we called it Manhattan. And we went up on the Hill to see these various people, and Mr. Stimson made the talk. You can hold that all the time. And it was very difficult to do because he couldn't explain just what it was, except it was a great secret. I can hold it here. It was a great secret. And he couldn't explain that secret. But they'd have to take his word for it and my word for it that it was of vital importance that we get this additional money. And it was of equally vital importance that not a word be breathed of what the thing really was. Well, they agreed that they would do all they could to avoid any debate or any discussion of this in committee. Well, when the time came, I was told that one member of the Military Appropriation Committee of the House, a fellow from down in Alabama, I think, who was very busy with all these things and had been unable to get into these plants at Timber Ridge or whatever the name, what is that down there? And the camp on the Columbia River, the plant on the Columbia River, had brought up in the committee this matter of the Manhattan Project and $600 million and stated that it had to be explained, and he was going to insist upon it. And they were in quite a dilemma as to how to handle this, because in a sense he had a right to demand that. And he was always out after this sort of a matter. He was the real busy bee in all this business, and particularly resentful of the fact that he had driven out in his car and hadn't been allowed to go through the plants. Well, the chairman called me up and told me that they couldn't do anything with him. And I believe I was out of town at the time. Anyway, I got back, and they'd gone into their final markup session, which is the closing out of the whole affair. And they still hadn't handled this man. So as nearly as I can remember the wording used, I went up to this meeting, which I had no right to be present. I didn't consult them. I just opened the door and walked in and sat down. Well, they were all very polite to me. They were all my friends. And I sat down, and then I addressed myself to this man. And as nearly as I can recall, I told him, I just learned this, and I just wanted to say to him that if he forced this thing into the open, if he forced a discussion, which would be a public discussion of something that Mr. Stimson, the Honorable Secretary of War, and myself had assured these people mustn't be discussed, mustn't be, they must trust us on this, as they did with the hundreds of thousands of lives of our soldiers, that if he did that, I was going to take the broadcasting radio over and make him ashamed of himself for the rest of his life. Then I got up and left the room. And he shut up and didn't make any more demands. I don't recall exactly the English I used, but that was the sense of it. And the rest of them accepted my apology for barging in on them. And we got by that last stumbling block in the effort to get the 600 million to add to what was over a billion and a half, I think, at that time. Of course, in all these things, it was exceedingly difficult to keep them secret, where you had to get at big money, such tremendous amounts as this, and had to build these great plants without explanation. I think only the fact that we were building so many of them diverted the public attention from these particular ones. As to Admiral Lay, he was not told what this was, because there was no necessity for telling him until the very last moment. We only told those that there was any necessity for telling. We didn't tell Arnold until it was time for him to train his particular pilots for launching the bomb in the Far East, and we didn't tell Spots, to his Spots, until he was ready to sail for the Far East. And I don't recall when we told General MacArthur, but it was the very last minute when we brought this matter out into the open. And but there were long discussions by Mr. Stimson and myself, and later with the special committee on this thing, of which Mr. Harrison acted as chairman in Mr. Stimson's absence from time to time. Senator Burns was on this committee, and he would come to Washington in connection with the meetings and was being accused of all sorts of political maneuvers, which were actually the meetings in connection with this atomic bomb affair.
Remember that press conference you had at Leesburg and those reporters asking you the same thing when Mr. Baruch was there?
Mm-hmm. We regarded the matter of the dropping of the bomb as exceedingly important. We had just gone through a bitter experience at Okinawa. We'd had been preceded by a number of similar experiences in other Pacific Isles and down in the north of Australia. The Japanese had demonstrated in each case they would not surrender and they would fight to the death. And even their civilians would commit suicide rather than be taken under control of the American forces. Well, with this knowledge, particularly of Okinawa, where I think we killed something like 120,000 Japanese, without a surrender, I think there were several badly wounded that we picked up, but literally not a surrender. It was to be expected that the resistance in Japan with their home ties would be even more severe. We'd had the terrific bombing. We'd had 100,000 people killed in Tokyo in one night by bombs. And it seemingly had no effect whatsoever. It destroyed the Japanese cities, yes, but their morale was not affected, as far as we could tell, at all. So it seemed quite necessary, if we could, to shock them into action. And what we didn't take into account, as nearly as I can recall, and I think my recollection is fairly plain in this, was the destruction would be so complete that it'd be a long time, or quite an appreciable time, before the actual facts of the case would get to Tokyo. So the destruction at Hiroshima was so complete that there were no communications, at least for a day, I think, maybe longer. And it wasn't until the second destruction took place at Nagasaki that the Japanese were really aware of what had happened in the earlier bomb explosion. And quite evidently, they were shocked into action, because as nearly as they could guess, They didn't know how many bombs we had. They didn't know the full details, but they knew the destruction had been terrific from a single bomb. And they'd been told something like that from Potsdam. But they didn't take it seriously. Now it had happened. They got the full word. What's the first place the bomb was exploded?
Hiroshima.
Of what had happened at Hiroshima. And now, very shortly thereafter, it had occurred again at Nagasaki. The fact that we had no more bombs completed at the time was unknown to the Japanese, and they could see Tokyo probably being wiped out next. And they were, as I think, shocked into immediate action, which otherwise we would not have gotten out of them. And we would have had a terribly bitter and frightfully expensive in lives and treasure, etc., if we would have had to have proceeded with a landing in Japan. There were supposed to be 9 more bombs completed in a certain time, and there'd be largely in time for the first landing in the southern tip of Japan. There were 3 corps to come in there, as I recall. And they didn't know about it at the time, but I'd gone very carefully into the examinations out at in New Mexico as to the after effects of the bomb, because we were having in mind exploding 1 or 2 bombs before these landings, and then having the landing take place, and reserving the other bomb or bombs for the later movements of any Japanese reinforcements that might try to come up. And it was decided then that the casualties from the actual fighting would be very much greater than might occur from the after effects of the bomb action. So there were to be 3 bombs for each corps that was landing. 1 or 2, but probably 1 as a preliminary. Then the landing. Then another one further inland against the immediate supports. And then the third one against any troops that might try to come through the mountains from up on the inland sea. And that was the rough idea in our minds. Now, Admiral Lay was not told until a meeting of the Chiefs of Staff very late in the game, just before the completion of the bomb, or I believe it had even been tested then. Maybe it hadn't. Anyway, it was the very end, and he was told of this, and he had been in the ordnance business in the Navy, quite familiar with explosives and things of that sort, and he utterly scouted the proposition of this and regarded it as largely a waste of money. And Admiral King and I were much shocked because of the money we'd